Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And in spirit, we are still eating our way through London.
We are indeed.
To start off with a dear, dear old friend, Chef Bruno Loubé, and his new concept, take it from the grain store, which followed his bistro, Loubé. And this one's called Grain Store Unleashed. So we'll have him tell us what he means by that. And it's in the place of where the bistro Loubé used to be. I think truly it would break my heart if we came to London and did not get to catch up with Bruno Loubé. Bruno, we're in yet another new venue, another new establishment. You're very exceedingly high talent. Thank you very much for talking to us. I think we should start with, we're sitting in the space I knew as Bistro Loubé, and it is no longer Bistro Loubé. It is now, tell us about it.
Now this is a grain store unleashed. So basically what we did, we take the idea, the concept of the grain store in King's Cross, which have been fantastic for us for the last 2 years, and decide to push a bit up and to do something a bit different, to try new things, to be a bit more free, to have more freedom in the cooking, and because obviously the grain store in King's Cross is very successful, but it comes with certain restrictions as well, because we do over 400 covers a day. So here we have the possibility to do something a bit different, because not so many covers, but still to explore the idea of using more vegetable in cooking, and less animal products.
Now, you've had this idea for a long time, and it's kind of an unusual idea for a Frenchman. What moved you in the direction of more vegetable-centric?
Firstly, I love gardening. You know, I love growing vegetables and fruits and herbs and a lot of stuff. So for me, I really like this connection with the earth, and I always did. And secondly, I always thought that in restaurant we don't really look at vegetable in the proper way. You know, it's always like a side little thing instead of being a complete part of the dish. That seemed to be usually the pattern. And also, I mean, of course, for me, the biggest things now is sustainability. I mean, it's not sustainable to eat the amount of meat we're eating. And it's far more sustainable and far more healthy to eat more veg. Now, I thought about this for many years, and that's the way I live myself. And then I decided to explore the idea and to look more in depth and make a lot of research. And then I realized that actually that was, as far as I'm concerned, it's definitely the way to go, because I'll say we can't sustain this amount of meat, and also for health reasons. And one of the biggest things maybe that nobody likes to talk about it, you know, the climate change on the planet, which is very much linked to farming the animals. So I think, you know, as a chef and as a grandfather now, having a granddaughter, I think it's important to look at things like that and to think about and have a bit of a side vision of what we used to.
But now you've had a great deal of success with the grain store, and now I guess also, I mean, it was crowded up until 3 minutes ago here in the grain store unleashed. So obviously you've hit on a vein where there's a lot of response and support from your clientele. Is this true? Tell us a little bit about, is it a general trend? I mean, is it not even a trend, but is it like something that's not hard to sell anymore? This is not a vegetarian stuff that's hard to sell. It's good food, and it's well received.
Yes, I think the first thing is to be, you know, we never try to impose anything to the customers. So we don't say, okay, that's what we do. You should be vegetarian, or you shouldn't eat meat, or you know, our approach always have been quite soft, and then you know. So the meat's still on the menu, but we use in very small quantities. So And then usually, you know, I like to believe anyway that people, when they leave the restaurant, they feel, wow, that was nice. But actually, they only have maybe 80 grams of meat instead of having 220 grams or something like that, you know, overall the meal, you know. I think it makes people realize, without pushing in their face, they just realize, oh, actually, that was really nice and that wasn't so heavy and we really enjoyed and it was colorful and it was tasty, it was interesting. And I think that's what it's about, you know. You need to, you know, people need to enjoy, and you don't want to detect anything to your customer, to your guest. And this approach has been very positive for us. People enjoy the fact that they can come here, eat. They still have a bit of meat, but not so much. And they appreciate, you know, they understand. So it's, I think that's what makes us, you know, quite successful.
Now, I mean, on a normal daily basis, I mean, I can see the people coming here doing that, but you do a lot of private parties, especially at your other restaurants, the Grain Store. How do people feel when they're planning a party?
Yeah, that's the thing, because, and especially these days, when we do parties, people expect to have a choice. They don't want to, you know, they are very worried that if you haven't got choice on the menu, a lot of people won't eat or won't like what's on the table or won't appreciate the meal. So, but for us at the Grain Store, because the kind of food we're doing, and we're doing a lot of sharing as well, we are allowed to provide big function, like 120 people, with three starters, three main courses, couple of desserts and cheese. And not many restaurants really in London are able to do that, so that put us in a better place, really. And
now we're going to go over, I believe Peter's going to talk about what we ate today.
I just grabbed the menu because I made a note of a couple of really inventive dishes. Well, first up we had zucchini flowers stuffed with vegetarian chorizo.
Well, it wasn't really chorizo.
Sure tasted a lot like chorizo. Yeah. And according to Bruno, the key ingredient was chickpeas.
Yep.
But the next one's even wilder. And this is called vegetal oyster and caviar bottom of the sea.
Right.
The only thing genuine on the plate was an oyster shell. I suppose you can get plenty of oyster shells if you really need them, empty ones. But this really was an absolutely amazing vegetarian concoction, if you like, that looked a whole lot like and really tasted a lot like a delicious oyster. Right, sweetheart?
Yes.
It really did. And then along with that was something that was made out of seaweed, and it was like a sheet of sort of a brown substance that was underneath the oyster, and it looked and tasted like the bottom of the sea, which is a very good place to be, I guess, if you're an oyster. And one dish that we didn't mention is a lamb shank reconstructed in the form of a cylinder. So you mustn't, listeners, you mustn't get carried away with the idea that this is an entirely a vegetarian restaurant. It's just a rather vegetarian restaurant because,
well, as I said, it's veggie centric, but right. there is meat on the menu.
But there's wood pigeon with a chili chocolate sauce,
which was wonderful,
and rabbit tornadoes with summer vegetables and parsley cream. What else can we say of it except go here?
It's
in the Zetter Hotel in the London neighborhood of Clerkenwell, right on St. John's Square. Just where Bistro Bruno Lube used to be. And you won't be disappointed. You'll be delighted. Now, for a visit to Bruno, whatever Bruno Lube is up to, is something we always include in our trips to London. We also like to sample ethnic in different varieties, of which London has lots and lots. The latest craze, probably, sweetheart,
yes,
is Peruvian.
Right.
And we went back to see our old friends at Coya Restaurant in a delightful premises on Piccadilly at the end near Buckingham Palace. And this time our friend Sanjay was away because for those of you who live in South Florida, there's all the excitement that there's a Coya Restaurant in Miami now, which he's getting off the ground. But he has a very capable assistant chef who's now the head chef at Coya in London, then named Gareth Rhodes. And we had lunch with Gareth, and then right after we talked to him about what it was that he cooked up for us.
You know, we may even qualify as alumna or friends of Koya in London, because we've sort of adopted it and they've sort of adopted us. We're talking now to the most recent and the current chef, Gareth Rhodes. And thank you for a lovely lunch, Gareth.
It was a pleasure to meet you, and I'm glad you enjoyed your lunch today.
It is a Peruvian restaurant. But first, I want to know about your background, because you're obviously not Peruvian.
No, I'm English through and through. Although I've worked for the company for 8 out of the last 10 years, I've covered quite a few cuisines. I was at Zuma right at the beginning, so that helps me here, the 2 years of Japanese food. I was at Le Petit Maison for 3 years doing French Provençal food, which is very, very different to what we're doing here. I'm just coming up to being involved with Koya for the third year now. I enjoyed in...
Oh, you mentioned the group. Maybe you should say what the group is. And I guess our buddy that first introduced us to Koya, Sanjay, is the corporate chef now. What's the group?
Well, we don't have a group title. It's owned by Mr. Wani, who I've known. Yes, very, very famous through Zuma, Roca. Not so known for Le Petit Maison, but great restaurant still. They have.
Do you have any idea what made him choose Peruvian? Because he opened Koya well in advance of when the whole craze for Peruvian food went worldwide. How did he get clued in on this?
I know they wanted to do something South American. There's a gentleman named Adam who's heavily involved from the beginning with the development with Sanjay. And they all went traveling in Peru and South America and, you know, into Miami as well to see what was happening. I remember being told about it and thinking, where did this come from? I was very shocked to hear that. I at the time knew nothing about Peruvian food myself. But once again, he's proven that he struck gold with it.
Yeah, I mean, it really has just catapulted onto the world radar. In your eyes, how would you define the flavors of Peru?
Well, for me, it's all about the chilies. They have the three main types, which, I mean, I've only worked with a couple of different chilies in my career, and the ones that they have in Peru, even when I visited there, they have an immense number of chilies. Just they have different names for dry ones than the fresh, and you know, it's a great mixture. But I think it's also the broad influences that they have from China and Japan that just opens everything up to experimentation. Basically, it's a fabulous cuisine to explore.
Yeah, I mean, we went of course to Lima, and there's just about everything. There's in terms of cuisine influences, there's native, there's Japanese, there's Chinese, there's it's just endless. It's a very exciting cuisine. Gareth Rhodes, you're not Gareth Rhodes. I thought you were on Strictly Come Dancing, but that's somebody who has a similar name, but it's not you.
Yes, I believe it's Gary Rhodes. He's a celebrity chef over here. Yes, my children will laugh when they hear this. They think I've got two left feet, so they certainly won't talk about my dancing exploits.
Now, you've traveled all the way through Peru and so on. And why do you think it's such a hit other places? And in London, it's been there. How many restaurants are there now? There are lots and lots of Peruvian restaurants, and they seem to all be very favored.
Well, there's a lot of people still wanting to join in the craze. I'd say there's probably 10 very good Peruvian restaurants worth visiting in London. I think it's it's following on from the Japanese craze that we've had for so long now, especially in London, that it's a very fresh, light food. If you eat the ceviche, it's very, very healthy. They don't use butter or cream or anything like that. It's a very healthy food, and you know, everybody knows that chili is good for your circulation, and it's following is not creating anything new other than. I just believe that it follows a lot of food trends in health. You know, there's lots of power foods that come from Peru and ingredients that we're still discovering here in London due to, you know, just them being available over here, basically. There's still a lot to discover.
What are some of the things that we had to eat today?
You had the tomato ceviche, which we've just recently put on the menu as a special, exploring it to get feedback to see if it's suitable to be on Koya's menu. You had the corvina with truffle ceviche, which is one of our bestsellers, if not the bestseller ceviche. It's Sanjay's modern take on our ceviche, and it's amazing. Depth of flavor and very, very exciting dish. Then you had the sweet corn salad, which is another top selling dish. You had a seasonal razor clam dish, which we put on for a couple of months every year. Always sells very well.
The beef.
Yeah, then you had the spicy beef and the cazuela, which are our two signature dishes. They sell the best everywhere, whether it's Dubai or Miami. It's the best-selling dishes that we have. We can sell 60 to 70 cazuelas in a night. It's phenomenal.
I notably did not have my corn sundae, which was the size of two heads. The last time I ate here, there's a picture, listeners, on our website of me with the corn sundae, and I ate every bit of it.
I had an interesting sourcing question, because those of us in the know, I suppose, realize that the fishery off the coast of Britain is still quite good, but I discovered this just by researching it. The fishery off Peru represents something like 20% of the worldwide fish catch. And that's one of the things that drives the fish that's in ceviche. How do you find that here in London, accessibility, ingredient-wise?
For meat and fish, I think we have a great selection available, whether it's from Europe or from Britain itself. The problem for us is the traditional Peruvian ingredients a bit more. We have a Peruvian supplier who supplies some of the best restaurants in London. But unfortunately, a lot of it comes in, you know, from Peru, and it's not always the best quality. I think standards are improving, but I think to keep it traditional, that's the things that we struggle with. I think the fish we have here is among some of the best in the world, I think.
So the catch here off the coast of Britain and off the coast of Europe is really suitable for what you need?
Yes, we have a wide variety of different fish. I mean, the tuna comes from across the globe in various different areas. But the majority we get from, we have a supplier that we call in the mornings. Well, two, in fact, that we call in the mornings, and they tell us what they've got from the day boats, and then it's with us fresh the next morning. And I think that's key to the freshness and the quality of our ceviche. Is you know, it has to be superbly fresh fish, otherwise it's just lost.
Well, we've been sort of dancing around it. The idea is we're in London for the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards, and I don't know who's in the top 50. I know who's in the second 50, so that gives me some idea who's not in the top 50. Do you have some favorites?
Well, we briefly talked about Massimo Bottura. I think he's doing some amazing things. I'd love to see someone from Britain get back in there, obviously, being an English player. Top of my head, I can't think. I mean,
well, you know, Simon Rogan did the big party for 100 at least, and some people said 150 right. of the chefs at his restaurant last night. Mm-hmm. Top chefs in the world. That's scary for pressure-wise, huh?
Yes, I wouldn't like to be involved in that at all. I think he's a very brave man, but he's certainly up to the challenge. He's an amazing chef. I think he's done very well with his restaurant in London to spread himself from one end of the country to the other.
Well, unlike former years, there's been no leak that I was able to identify as to who's going to be doing that.
We shouldn't close, by the way, without noting that this is during the day. The awards are tonight. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that Koya will win an award. But more importantly, you did win one last year as best new restaurant doing something in the London area. Tell our listeners about that.
It was London Lifestyle Awards, best restaurant. I think we came under the radar a little bit. People really didn't expect us to get it because we weren't involved in the initial ratings. But then when they opened it up to the public, there was such a high demand about Koya that they had to consider us. So I was very lucky to go to the event with Alex Santamaria, our general manager at the time, and pick up and receive the award. And it was nice to bring it back for the guys for all the hard work that they've done, because it's, you know, not just me creating Koya.
Well, I tell you, we send people here all the time. People are going to be in London, and they all come back with great reports because there's a spirit about Koya that, I mean, it elevates the whole dining experience. And I thank you for giving us this once again.
No, it's a pleasure. I think, yeah, it's a full experience coming to Koya from the minute you walk in through the Pisco Lounge, when we have the live music and the members club, and it's not just a dining experience. You have the, you feel the atmosphere as soon as you walk in through the door.
Okay, you're checking out, but that's great. I thank you so, so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you both, and hopefully we'll hook up again sometime. Enjoy yourselves at the 50 Best tonight.
Listeners, this is a man who leaves it on the plate. Gareth Rhodes, the unique one, not the one on Strictly Come Dancing, the one who puts it on the plate every day. Thank you so much for joining us and talking to our listeners, and who knows when we'll see you again, but I know we're going to read more great things about you.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
You did a great job.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and here's a tricky question for you, Mrs. Rabideau, sweetheart.
Yes?
What would you say was the first ethnic cuisine in London?
I would say French.
That was going to say exactly the same thing. From the years I spent in London, if you were looking for almost what most people would class as a decent restaurant meal, then the restaurant that you went to was French. But in fact, the answer is probably slightly different than that. It's probably Indian.
Yeah, well, but at least the British version of it.
Yeah, but Indian has gone from strength to strength in London, with Indian restaurants getting Michelin stars, and one of the leaders of the pack in this whole movement is a very intriguing gentleman, his sister and his sister-in-law, who it turns out, you'll never guess, were exact contemporaries of Peter at the University of Cambridge, but they studied economics, not geography. Absolutely amazing.
We had a good time chatting
about old times as well.
And fellow classmates and this and that and the other.
But more importantly,
I was staring around at this absolutely splendiferous establishment. Yeah, boy, it's a knockout.
And we're going to talk about that, because it's not just a great Indian restaurant with a very elegant atmosphere. It's far more than that.
Here
to tell us the story of how it all began and how it's still going strong is the leader of the group that put the concept of Chutney Mary together, and then a series of restaurants afterwards.
I've been interviewing for as long as I can remember, but I'm really not just timid about this. I'm totally intimidated about somebody called Ranjit Mathrani, who has so many credentials, I don't even know where to begin. Raji, you have to give us a little bit of the background. We will start specifically in identifying your group, which is MWEAT, and you're going to tell us about your background, your wife's background, her sister's background, which is the backbone of this incredible business.
Thank you for those kind words. Firstly, in terms of the restaurants which we own, we now have 11 restaurants in London, of which 3 are fine dining. 7, the 3 fine dining are Amaya, Chutney Mary, and Viraswamy. The fine dining, the informal dining, which we have 7, is Masala Zone restaurants. And then we created a new restaurant for Masala Grill about a month ago. So we have now 11 restaurants. But turning to our background, the three of us, my wife, my sister-in-law Camelia, my wife Namita, my sister-in-law Camelia and I run the business, which is owned by Namita, my wife, and myself. And it's now 25 years, almost to the day, that we started on the restaurant business. And it started with the creation of Chutney Mary. Of the three of us, Camelia, my sister-in-law, has been the one full-blooded, blue-blooded hospitality professional. She became the main board director of the Taj Group at the age of 24, 26 years of age, and the Taj Group is one of the most successful hotel groups in Asia, with 65 hotels, and when she started, there was one hotel, and when she retired to join us full-time, there were 68 hotels, and in which she and her boss helped to build up. And food has been one of her passions. Her cookbook called 50 Great Curries of India has sold 1.5 million copies, more than practically any other cookbook on Indian food in the world. And so she's a hospitality professional. And then I met my wife, Namita, through her, having been at Cambridge with Camelia. And Namita had a previous background in banking as well as fashion. By the way, both Camelia and Namita had economic degrees from Cambridge. And so when Namita, having been a very successful fashion accessory designer and merchandiser in India, came to London 27, 28 years ago, when he got married, they both came from gourmet family backgrounds, and so they all had a passion for very good food, and they had and therefore an interest in food has been part of their early mother's milk, as it were. And so out of that, and when we got married, the idea came of how Namita should spend her time and develop her time here in London. My background is that I have been in the British government as a senior civil servant for 17 years, having worked, including that, with Margaret Thatcher on the early privatizations, and I covered industrial and economic policy. I then went to run investment banks. I was a director of Lazards and managing director of several investment banks in the UK. And then I created my own advisory business, where we advise on privatizations around the world. And so, in a way, the restaurant business is the last incarnation for me. And so out of that process, when I was the director of Lazards, the idea came for Namita to develop a restaurant advised by Camelia, and out of that, Chutney Mary was born. And from there, I assisted in organizing partners, raising the finance, and creating the business environment within which Camelia, which Namita could then run and create Chutney Mary together with our partners.
Now, that's exciting.
That's interesting. The story of the success of Indian restaurants in London is legendary. But we're in a new place now. Where you're launching a new beginning after all these years, and you are on a rather prestigious street in the St. James area of London. This is really coming uptown, isn't it?
Yes. Chutney Mary is 25 years old, and we're moving Chutney Mary to the heart of the West End, St. James's Street, after 25 years. And I don't think there are very many restaurants in the world which would up sticks and move 3 to 4 miles, even though they are at the top of the game where they are, and move. And we decided to move Chutney Mary about 2 or 3 years ago. We took a decision. The lease of Chutney Mary is coming to an end, and we decided that really, given the standing, given its position in the marketplace, and given the effort and time which politically which Namith and Camille devoted to it, it really, from attracting the level of clientele which we thought it would need, it wasn't actually really justifying that attention. London had changed in 25 years. That when Chutney Mary started, there were very few upscale, good quality restaurants in London of any cuisine. There were even fewer of Indian cuisine. And Chutney Mary became a destination restaurant very soon after it opened, where it attracted people really from all over London, from Britain, and from all over the world. Over the years, as you all know, London having become one of the gastronomic capitals of the world, the West End, where we are now, became the heart of the upscale restaurant industry. People were much less willing to travel the distances to Chutney Mary, even though it's profitable. Despite that, it remained profitable and successful. But when you compared it with our other fine dining restaurants, like Amaya and Viraswamy, where we're devoting the same amount of effort, we felt that the right location in the end for Chutney Mary was in the heart of the West End.
Now, I'm sitting in this luxurious new space of yours. I am amazed at the sheer beauty of every single appointment. The art on the walls, the flatware, the table settings, the lighting. Somehow, especially given your background and the success of Chutney Mary and all the awards you've won in earlier on, there has to be another reason why you took this big step. What actually is the mission of your business venture this time, and does it have something to do with a cultural mission?
We have been the pioneers of Indian food in Britain, of real Indian food in Britain. That's why our website, our domain, is called realindianfood.com. That puts a flag on where we want to be. And that has been really part based on the Camille and Namita's culinary background. Chutney Mary was then started as being effectively our flagship. Given where London had moved into in terms of the fine dining scene, we felt that we wanted to bring in the heart of the West End, Chutney Mary, and also in the context of doing that, actually represent, portray, and present really the evolution of Indian food together with an evolution of a fine dining concept as being our last fling. And that, therefore, we took this decision to move it here.
Does it stay in England, or is this going to be an empire, a global empire?
We see our two groups of restaurants very differently. Masala Zone, which is an informal dining brand, is something which is capable of replication, capable of being transported to other parts of the world, and has been designed to do that. And therefore, it is quite likely to be on the cards that that will happen in the Salar Zone. For the fine dining restaurants, you know, we have been approached repeatedly over the years. I think we get about 20 to 30 inquiries every year to do one of our fine dining restaurants somewhere in the world. And we have resisted all these blandishments primarily for two reasons. One is because London has provided enough opportunity for us to be able to develop our restaurants. But secondly, there are very few parts of the world where we'll be able to get the work permits we need in order to run an establishment of the type we need. In our restaurants, we have, in a fine restaurant, we have an average of 10 highly specialized, some of the best Indian chefs in the world, in each restaurant. And because we have pursue a policy of total culinary integrity. Culinary integrity means India is a continent. India is the size of Europe. India has 16 different cuisines. It has 420 dialects, 8 languages, 4 scripts, whatever, 16 language, 4 scripts. And we have in our restaurants at any one time about 8 to 10 specialists, each one often from their own region of India, which in other parts of the world we call a country. So because of that integrity, we cannot do restaurants where we can, where as other people sometimes do, which is have one or two chefs from India and then have local assistants helping them. So I think in that sense, I think our culinary integrity limits the choices of where we want, where we're able to go in terms of a fine dining restaurants.
No, I remember that message from when we went to Amaya, one of your more recent restaurants, and we were there within a year of it opening. And the thing that was remarkable is that the kitchen was staffed with people who really knew what they were doing, not who had learned it, but who had lived with it growing up. And we were actually surprised at some of the ingredients that were there. I remember I never knew before that liver was a favorite dish in India, but we had it there and it was delicious. But it's interesting that you should say that if this is part of what you do, then you really can't come to the United States. You really can't go to other countries where there isn't a really open immigration policy. Here there is.
I'll throw in here that there has never in New York City ever succeeded an upscale fine dining Indian restaurant.
And that is exactly why. Because I don't blame the Indian restaurants in other parts of the world. They make the best of a bad job in terms of what they have by way of limitations of immigration. And you know, we've been approached many times in New York, including by some incredibly well-known American restaurateurs whose names I won't mention now. But you know, and we've had to say no to them for that very reason on that side. And you know, looking ahead, I think about the only parts of the world where we see the ability to recruit or be able to have work permits for staff would really be Asia. By Asia, I'm talking about Middle East, I'm talking about Southeast Asia, I'm talking the Far East, where they are more used to and are willing to allow people to come through. So unfortunately, you know, the States and Europe is not an area where we would see ourselves as being able to expand at the fine dining level.
I describe the fact that I am just overwhelmed by the sheer beauty and opulence of this restaurant. Even more impressive is what I noted, just reading your press materials, that you seem to cover just about any need for just about everybody, and it's going to be soon breakfast through dinner. But give us an overview of your dining program, the bar, the restaurant, so forth.
I think one of the interesting things and exciting things about this site is the fact that we will do, be seeking to do a number of things, well, two main things which we haven't done before. One of which is to have a bar, and the other is to do breakfast. The bar is pretty exciting because if you look around the world, there are very few bars and upscale restaurants of outside European and American descent, and here we've got a, because of the configuration of the space, we have a large imposing room as you enter. And as we thought about it, we said we had to do a bar there. And out of that bar has evolved a structure of a bar where we made it a combination. I suppose it could be almost like an Hediard in Paris, or where it's a bar come upmarket cafe where we can go from pure drinking to snacking to eating light. Or to having tea or coffee or whatever. Now that's the vision, and hopefully it'll work. But that remains to be seen. The breakfast is again something for us which is going to be an interesting challenge, because breakfast is one meal in the day where people are the most conservative. As people become less conservative as the day progresses, and they're most willing to try new things at dinner, lunch is in between, and breakfast are very conservative. So by definition, you have to have a breakfast menu, which is traditional in large measure, which is what it will be, and then have add-ons from India as way of Indian dishes, but as a supplement, because if you are a finance director or chief director of a large company, the last thing you want is to have to mess around deciding what you want to eat at breakfast. And that will be, I think, a very interesting experience for us.
And I think that the regional nature of this is particularly going to be important to your success, because the draw is going to be huge. People don't realize the diversity of India. As you said, each of these regions would be called a country anyplace else. And I think that's what you made your mark initially about. It was the first regional Indian restaurant of the stature anywhere. I still go back to this question. You, who have achieved so much in business, I can't imagine you're willingly entering into a condition of, it's probably the greatest failure rate of any business in the United States, the restaurant business. What gave you the guts to do this?
I was in a very fortunate position, speaking as a former investment banker. As an investment banker, we spend our time trying to identify talent and then monetize it or help them to make money, and you make money in the process. Here, I was in the unique situation of having both a sister-in-law and a wife who are amongst the most talented individuals in the curry profession, in the curry business in India, with a combination not only of a wide-ranging palate but also dedication. And therefore, for me, it actually started the other way around. We've worked and developed in a fairly crab-like manner. You know, it's been 25 years. I wouldn't say that 11 restaurants of 25 years was actually rocket-like in progress, but it's been measured and been cautious. And each step is built on each other. But I've never had any doubt in my mind that given the talents of Camila and Amitha, that we would ever not succeed, because the two of them are amazing by way of the talents. And so, it's also done on a step-by-step basis. There's been a very measured progress over time. And interestingly enough, because of the success of Camila's first restaurant in London, which is the Bombay Brasserie, I did not perceive it as being high risk. It's only afterwards I realized the risk, the failure rate in restaurants in London.
But that was for other people. You haven't had a failure rate at all, have you?
No, we haven't. And I think what's very interesting about coming out of the restaurant business as I've done from the outside is that a restaurant business, particularly when you do it on with restaurants of the size which you've done, require a combination of skills which are very often hard to bring together in the restaurant, because it's not only the quality of the food, it's not only the ability to deliver consistently, it's also the ability to control costs and control numbers, to manage staffing issues, to manage public relations and marketing issues, and the ability as well to run a professional business. And one of the remarkable coincidences of three of us coming together is we have complementary skills. And so, in a way, the fit has been extremely good, with Camila being the big vision person and the big concept person and the marketing person. Namitha's ability to then harness that at culinary levels and take that level of detail and consistency together with decoration. And then my interest, not only in the business sense, but as a former investment banker, my passion is service. And therefore, I remember one of the riveting experiences I had was at Union Square Cafe when I was an investment banker, and that made a great impression on me. And one of the things I tried to do is to bring actually the hospitality standards of the best American restaurants in New York to Europe. I never been terribly enamored of what people in Europe called good service standards, because good service standards for many people here is polite, courteous, unsmiling, and fundamentally unfriendly service. Whilst your best American service is not only professional, but it's warm and welcoming as well. So I'm a great fan of top hospitality service in New York. And so services for me has been one of my passions. The other passion has been design as well. So therefore, in a way, we all complement each other, and that's been one of, I think, the reasons why we've been able to manage without losing money.
Well, it has been a genuine pleasure to meet the man behind a legend. And those of you who know London dining and know Indian dining in London know exactly what I mean. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And now we have to apply ourselves to a rather extensive menu and enjoy dinner.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure interacting with both of you. Thank you.
And before we go to break, I should interject at this point that this soft-spoken gentleman is quite the opposite in terms of what he's achieved in a really dynamic career, including working for several years for Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
He's brilliant. In fact, the really great thing about this is how intelligent these people are, and what a pleasure it was to talk to them about all manner of things.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, and I know you know the answer to this next question. What's the hottest ethnic cuisine just now in New York City and some other places around the world, and starting to evidence itself in London?
Of course, it's Israeli cuisine, and as I said in the interview, I'm surprised it took so long for it to get there. It's, of course, part of this whole passion everybody has developed for Middle Eastern cuisine, me included, I might add. And I want to say that it was a pleasure going to this Honey and Company restaurant, which was precipitated by the owners, both chefs, publishing a cookbook, which we got a review copy of, and we said, oh, and instead of just doing a phone interview like we always do with cookbooks, why don't we just talk to them in person? We're going to be in London.
So we had a fine old time. And
we enjoyed it so much.
Lots of other people were enjoying themselves at the same time, as I'm sure you'll be able to tell.
Yes. Well, here we are in London, our first stop right off the plane from the U.S. at Honey and Company, which I've been dying to come to because I saw their cookbook that they just wrote, and it's exactly the kind of food that I adore. It's Middle Eastern, it's Israeli-based, and we're going to be talking now to the owner chefs, Sarit Packer and Itamar Strulovich. Say hello, and would you please give us some idea of how you ended up in London? What is your background?
Hi. Hi, welcome to London. Hi, welcome to our restaurant. I'm Sarit. We moved here 11 years ago from Israel after being chefs for a while, and we wanted to try and see the world a bit and cook in different places. But we ended up sticking to London for a while, and about 3 years ago we managed to open our first small place, which is here, so we cook food from home.
Well, Itamar, tell us your background, which is a sort of parallel, but you always, and you had a good explanation of that, you seem both of you to be cooks since you were 5 years old.
Well, I think we've both been home cooks for a long time, so I think when I finished the army and I thought what I'm going to do, it was just natural for me to go in the kitchen. I said, I'll just cook until I decide what I want to do with my life. And then 20 years later, I'm still searching. But yeah, I think for both of us, cooking is very natural and very sort of easy, and we enjoy it.
I can't interrupt him speaking.
The problem is,
I keep wanting to jump in and correct what he's saying, because we usually kind of cut up each other, but into one microphone, I'm going to let him speak for himself today.
No, I said when we were chatting before that Israeli cuisine is having a big moment in the United States. And here, of course, too, has been promulgated by Chef Otto Lenghi. And you had an explanation for why.
Yeah, I think the food from the Middle East should have really come to the forefront earlier. It's really fresh. It uses a lot of fruit and vegetables. It's protein heavy. It's really beautiful colors, really good for you to eat, quite easy to prepare, and it's very convivial. You share big platters of food, you eat meze together. It's really, really light, and it's surprising to me that it hasn't become a bigger thing earlier on.
I agree. I think, again, like I said to you before, there's so much, we're always looking for the new cuisine, like Italian was so big a couple of years ago, and Japanese. And you're just discovering these new traditions and new preparations that are new for you, but have been around for centuries. And I think it's a wonderful journey. It's a wonderful.
Well, you know, I've always said the same thing about Greek cuisine, because I owned a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia a long time ago, and I kept thinking that it was going to be right around the corner, and yet it's never caught on the way that Israeli cuisine is. And there are similarities about most of these Middle Eastern cuisines. Tell us what you think is a flavor profile of Israeli cuisine.
I think in a way what we call ourselves is food from the Middle East, and we include Greece and Turkey in that because the whole region uses the same aspects of food. So the spicing is very much based on cumin, coriander, and then a lot of fresh herbs, mostly parsley, mint, fresh thyme, and then olive oil is a big thing, lemons, garlic, and chili. And all these things repeat themselves throughout the region. They sometimes get a bit of different guises, and a lot of vegetables, the use of tomatoes, of peppers, of aubergines is a massive thing throughout the region. So all of these things that, as well as being grown...
Eggplants.
Sorry, it's true. Not aubergines. Eggplants. All these things are also being grown more for import and export. So the markets are much more open. So I think the food is having a moment because you can get a lot more of these ingredients everywhere. But also another kind of big thing for us is nuts. Use of nuts, pistachios, almonds, walnuts. They get used so much throughout the food and give such a good flavor. And the more available all these ingredients are coming, the more the food is coming to the forefront. And I think people's consciousness about eating a bit more healthily is really a big thing, because the grains that are used, cracked wheat or frika or you know, various things like what's it called? I've lost the name now. Like farro. Spelt it. All these things, they're all becoming kind of more the trend to eat, and they're a big part of the food. So that's all coming, and we definitely see Greece, Turkey, Lebanon, Israel as the same thing in terms of it was a really transient place in terms of occupations and people moving from place to place, and the food is really the same throughout the region.
Well, you know, I have some ideas about one of them is textural contrast, which we've had in the food today, and the other is the use of acid, a lemon particularly, to brighten the flavors. But I'm going to turn this microphone over to you, Itamar, to talk about in detail what the dishes were that we ate today.
Okay, it's quite a lot to remember, because you had pretty much everything we cooked today. So definitely we sent you all our bread. We bake between 3 and 5 types of bread a day. We do traditional flatbread, a little bit less traditional potato bread, and milk bread, which is a little bit like Jewish challah, maybe. We send you our falafel that's seasoned with coriander, and you get a fluffy tahini sauce with it. Hummus we make here every day. Fresh tabbouleh salad we make here every day. Labneh you got with marinated aubergines. It's such a nice combination, I think. You had a little spring salad, didn't you? With manouri cheese that is Greek and a little lemon sauce. I think it's a really nice dish. Your mains, we had shawarma, that is our slow-cooked lamb shoulder, that we serve with amba.
Closer?
Yeah. That we serve with amba, which is a mango relish. We cook it for 3-4 hours with our spice mix that we make. You had mackerel with garlic leaf labneh and lentil salad, beautiful Scottish mackerel, cooked Middle Eastern way. And you had pomegranate molasses chicken on a cracked wheat and mint salad with currants, pomegranates, and pistachios. Good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about texture, you bite into that chicken, and it's beautifully cooked as a protein anyhow. And then you have it with, you bite through the pomegranate, you get one kind of a flavor. You bite into the pistachio and you get the crunch, and I love that, and I love what we have to admit that we have not had dessert simply because we do not have the room for it, but you have an array of desserts, and I see people coming in here stopping by just to have tea and dessert, and oohs and ahs all around when you brought out the desserts. Could we just mention your cookbook for a little bit? It's a beautifully done cookbook. This is your first?
Yeah, it's our first cookbook, and it's really kind of a labor of love of the first year of opening this restaurant. It's all the recipes we collected. At the beginning, it was just Itamar and myself cooking in the kitchen, and we kind of would cook the food we know without recipes so much. But once we got busier and started hiring chefs, we had to write the recipes for them to cook, because none of them are actually Middle Eastern, and in putting all the recipes together to them, this kind of book created itself. So it's all the recipes that we've been serving throughout the year, the first year here, kind of made, and we have quite a domestic kitchen here, so all the recipes apply for a domestic home as well, and we just kind of put it all in a book, and really a lot of pictures here. We shot everything in the restaurant. The stories are about our staff and about our customers and about suppliers and things like that, so it was kind of a big part of us opening the restaurant, writing a book about it.
Well, I can tell you that the two women over here got it when it first came out, the British edition, and they've been cooking since last Christmas. They've been cooking out of it. So, and I asked them, I'm nervy that way. I said, do the recipes work? They said, yes, they do. Well, it's a pleasure being here. People obviously feel at home here and love it, and they love the food, and we certainly enjoyed everything that we ate.
Just a little bit of a typical Peter's geographical warning. We came here by cab, and the cab could only get us so far down Warren Street because there are barriers that come out of the ground that stop you from driving through. So this is a horrendous traffic area. The best way to get here probably is to walk, or you can go to the underground station right on the corner of Warren Street, walk down. The number scheme you won't get it right. You just have to keep on going west until you get to 25A and see the awning, and then you'll be okay.
Just follow your nose. Either follow the cumin smell, or if there's strawberry jam, you can smell it all across the street. It's nice.
Well, thank you so much. It's been so much fun meeting you as well.
Thank you so much. And if you end up cooking anything from the book, tweet us a picture. We love to see people's results.
So there you have it. Until the same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then.
Until then.
Oh, I'm waiting. It's a cliffhanger.
Bye-bye.